Hey, hey, it's the fan call-in show, so remember two things. One, my voice will probably sound worse than it does right now. And two, spoiler alert, if you have not seen the latest episode of Game of Thrones. Thanks for listening. Dedicated to the HBO series Game of Thrones and George R.R. Martin's Song of Ice and Fire book series. This is Podcast Winterfell. And now here's your host, Matt Murdock.
And welcome to Podcast Winterfell. This is episode 10, the fan call-in show for episode 4 of season 2, or episode 14, if you prefer, of Game of Thrones, entitled Garden of Bones. This episode was written by Vanessa Taylor, who, as I understand it, is also writing episode 6 this year, and directed by David Petrarca. I hope I pronounced his name right. Again, apologies to Mr. Petrarca if I said it wrong. A little bit about the podcast before we get into our callers. We do have several lined up right at the top here, so I'll try and be as brief as possible. First of all, thanks to the folks that have come and given us a rating on iTunes. You can do so as well. Simply go to your iTunes apparatus on your computer, type in Podcast Winterfell at the iTunes Store search engine. We should pop up. Click on that page. Give us a star rating. Maybe leave us a review so that we can make this podcast as good for you as is possible. If you want to find back streaming episodes of the podcast, you can certainly do so by going to podcastwinterfell.wordpress.com, which is where you will also find polls in order to rate the episode. The episodes get rated, and I include that in my feedback section on the Friday podcast, so please do that before 12 a.m. EDT Thursdays. You can also find the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/podcastwinterfell, or you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/winterfellpod. You can always submit feedback by calling our listener line, 314-669-1840, or by sending an email to podcastwinterfell@gmail.com. This episode is particularly about your thoughts about this episode, Garden of Bones. And anytime there's a new episode of Game of Thrones airing on a Sunday, the following night, on Monday night, at 9 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, you can call in and talk to me and tell me what you thought about that particular episode. You simply call 724-444-7444, and then when prompted for a call ID number, 118884 and the pound sign. If you're already a TalkShoe member, your phone may already automatically put you into our call list. If not, you can simply dial 1 plus the pound sign and be added as a guest, as our first caller did. A brief summary of episode 14, Garden of Bones. Rob scores another victory for the North, but meets a woman who gives him a different perspective on his victories. In King's Landing, Joffrey continues his evil practices of propaganda and cruel revenge, while Tyrion enlists the help of his cousin as a double agent to spy on his sister Cersei. The captured Arya and Gendry are taken to Harrenhal, where they are acquainted with the cruel practices of a new and improved The Mountain, and the patriarch of the Lannister house, Tywin, as Arya continues reminding herself of her need for revenge. Lord Littlefinger Baelish comes to Renly's camp to fulfill Tyrion's wishes and extends his mission to hopefully gain from any possible outcome of a pending war. Meanwhile, in the east, Daenerys and her people find the city of Carth and are nearly left to die if not for one of the apparent ally city elders' pledge to take responsibility for them. Finally, the brothers Baratheon face off, resulting in Stannis sending Davos and Melisandre on a mysterious and magical mission. All right, so that is the episode in somewhat of a nutshell, although it is much more complex than any little summary like that can put into words. My overall rating for this episode is really only barely an 8 out of 10. And don't get me wrong, the story itself, the plots, are very good in this episode. There were just a few things that kind of took me out of the episode itself. I mean, some of the wow factor, especially towards the end, was fantastic. And even a good portion of the visual effects were okay. But some of them also completely took me out of the story in several places. I don't really have that much of a problem with the CG models themselves, but I always am and continually finding problems with the blending and the matting of the visual effects within the live action. It doesn't, it makes it feel very Doctor Who-ish to me, BBC Mill. And that's something that, it's just a nitpicky thing of mine, but it does take me out of the episode. It distracts me from things that I ought to be paying attention to. And that's why I kind of had a problem with so much visual effects in this particular episode. Additionally, some of the dialogue, especially the more humorous parts of the dialogue, seemed a little bit forced to me, almost like our writer, and not necessarily from a performance perspective, but almost like our writer was trying to inject some lightness into some of these dark themes, and it just didn't quite come across for me. Of course, Peter Dinklage always does a great job, in my opinion, but some of the other stuff, and even some of the more dramatic stuff, just felt like it was being forced a little bit. Not rushed in terms of the story. I feel like we needed to advance this much in the story, but just that some of the dialogue itself didn't feel quite natural enough to me. There's also a startling difference, and it became very apparent to me in this episode. There's a big difference in the speed at which characters are moving from place to place. Now, granted, I know that this has a lot to do with needing to cut time down. But if you recall in Season 1, say on the King's Road or while hunting, there was a lot of stuff that we got on those kind of on-the-road moments that were particularly true to Martin's first book. Now, I haven't read the second book, so maybe Martin is jumping around the same in the books as they are here in the series. But it is a definite difference when you have Tyrion in King's Landing telling Baelish to go to see Renly, and then all of a sudden Baelish is there. At the same time, in that course of time, we see Joffrey and Arya already at Harrenhal. We get no idea of whether they actually took Gendry or took that boy to be Gendry or not. We don't get that kind of resolution to the cliffhanger, so to speak. All of these kind of little jumps, Stannis even, sailing from Dragonstone all the way down to Storm's End. And this is all just like Catelyn last week suddenly showing up at Storm's End, even though an episode had happened, I suppose. But it's still, we get jumps of days and days of things. The two scenes between Daenerys being in the Red Waste and then suddenly at Carth. There was supposed to be, 3 days ride difference, according to the scout. And that's on a horse. Now, all of a sudden, we're jumping forward to a city, and I'm getting a problem. I'm feeling really displaced with the sequence and the chronology of events. I almost feel like in some places, maybe these two scenes that happen after are actually supposed to overlap back a little bit or are supposed to overlap forward a little bit. I understand that from a book's perspective because then you can gravitate different points, but in a show perspective, it becomes a lot harder. So those are my main criticisms, and that's why I didn't rate this episode. I mean, on a plot level, this story would have been a 9 easily to me. but just on the execution level, and I feel partially from the writing level, and perhaps a little bit from the direction level as well. Not so much the execution by the actors, but just from those two key points from which the actors have to base their performance upon. That's what took it down the whole notch to barely an 8 for me. With that, before I get into going into specifics about the episode, I'm actually going to get in our first caller. We are graced once again with the presence of Ken from Chicago. Ken, thanks so much for calling in.
Glad to be here.
Last week, you were a big hit among our listeners. I received several tweets saying, boy, this guy really knows his stuff, so I'm so happy to have you back. And the floor is yours after you give me a rating of 1 to 10.
Well, I think I liked the episode more than you did, though I can understand and appreciate the few criticisms that you leveled. I acknowledge them. I guess they just didn't take me out of the show really at all. So I'm going to give it a 9 out of 10. I easily thought that it was the second best episode of the season, the first being last week's episode. And then I think this one was right behind it.
Fair enough. Very cool. Let me ask you this. Being as a person who has now read the second book, correct?
Yes.
Did that make all of these little jumps around and the quick jumping up of events, does that make that easier for you than you think if you were just watching it as a TV show?
You know what, it does, because I don't know if there's a huge difference in the jumps between the TV show and the book. So I think I was a little... The other thing about the book is you always get the sense that timelines are overlapping, like you just so intelligently supposed, that sometimes you get the sense that things are either happening ahead of time from maybe the last chapter you read, or something is happening before the time of the last chapter that you read. So timelines rarely feel synced up in the book. And like you said, that can often work better in a book. A TV show, by its very nature, I think needs to be, or at least try to be, a little more linear in its time anyway. But that probably prepared me for not being disrupted by the TV show.
Okay. Cool. I'm sure that after I read the book and I kind of look back on the season after it's over, that some of my more nitpicky criticisms will probably go away. However, where I am standing now, just as more or less just as a TV viewer, I just found it a little bit, I guess, confusing. But that's near here nor there. You now have the floor, sir. What's the first point that you would like to talk about?
Well, I have to compliment this episode because I think it did something that I didn't know if the TV show was going to be able to get away with. And I'm not talking about the violence, which was really terrible in this episode, but we'll get into that later, I'm sure. But there's this whole thing in the second book about how the war is affecting the common folk. And I didn't know if the TV show was actually going to have the time to get into that, because they have so many characters that they have to go between. But I thought this episode did a great job of, like, in particular, the scene between Rob and the field nurse. And then also all the scenes at Heron Hall with the common folk being herded into cages and tortured for information. And even the scene with Joffrey and the two prostitutes, he was really mad at his uncle. He was really mad at Robb Stark, but he took it out on these two women who had nothing to do with it. So I thought the episode did a great job of, like, showing us how war is affecting people who aren't making the decisions.
Yeah, I have to agree with you there in terms of that, especially this new character, or at least this guest character, which was played by Una Chaplin. I think she's Charlie Chaplin's granddaughter, believe it
yeah.
or not.
Yeah.
And she's called, I think, Talissa?
Yeah, that's what I got as well.
All right. Yeah, and I wasn't aware of this other country that was named either, and I don't know if it's something that's canon or something that's made up, but let's see, what was it called?
It was Volantis.
Volantis, yes, that is it. At any rate, it kind of does give her own kind of mystique, and I appreciated the fact that she never really revealed whether she was like a quote-unquote neutral party or whether she was, you know, working for the Lannisters. It was cool that, of course, nobody like held her captive for working for the Lannisters or the possibility of it. Of course, that wouldn't be really the Stark way anyway in terms of medical things. But I thought that their conversation was very enlightening as kind of a counterpart, because I really think that many of these warring folks are seeing things, or the people at the heads of these wars are seeing things just as an us and them kind of thing. And she did make it a much more personalized thing, just like you said, which I absolutely loved.
Yeah. And she did another thing. She pointed out a weakness in Rob, which, you know, up until now, you know, you may think Rob is the best of the five kings vying for power. And in many ways he is, but she pointed out one of his glaring weaknesses, which is that he had no contingency plans. Like, he wasn't thinking beyond the victory. He wasn't putting his cause in any sort of context. And she pointed that out. And so that, it didn't make Rob seem unlikable, but it definitely made him seem limited.
Yeah, I think what even made it more limited to me was the fact that he acknowledged it and didn't seem to make an apology for it. He says,
right.
First you have to win the war. You know,
right.
That was definitely an exclamation point to the point she was trying to make to him. I mean, if he didn't drill it home to himself at that point, then you do have to worry about his ability to, you know, see things through all the way through in a proper way. Very good point. Very good point. I'll give you a chance to make another point about the episode, or if you want to expand upon anything else that we've talked about so far, is fine.
The only other point that stands out for me was, of course, the ending scene. I actually worried about that when I read it in the book. It seemed like a big jump in the stature of the magic in the show. But I actually thought the show did a better job of preparing us for that final scene. In the books, we never got to see, like, the scene in the second episode where Stannis and Melisandre have sex on the table. That's not a scene from the book. But I really feel like that scene prepared us for the magic that she was going to use to birth her shadow baby or smog monster baby. Lost reference. And the one of the other things I love about Martin is that he always presents magic with a cost. Like Miri Mazdoor in the first season talks about that. Everything has a cost. So she uses blood magic, right? So with Melisandre, there's also a cost. Like, I got the sense that she couldn't have had that baby without Stannis. Like, it wasn't just like her waving a magic wand and conjuring up this shadow demon. She had to use Stannis's sperm, in essence, to create this monster. And I love how practical that magic is.
You know, I'm so glad that you brought that up, because that was one of the big questions that I had here in my notes, is that was the physical intimacy with Stannis necessary in order for this to happen? And I'm glad that I'm not alone in thinking that that was a possibility. I also had wondered if it was the fact that Davos, you know, she kind of unveils this fact that he has kind of this fascination with her, whatever, sexually. I almost felt like all of it was in play in order to generate the magic that was necessary. It doesn't have to just be the physical seed per se, but also had to be some kind of ethereal desire as well in order to kind of breathe a spirit into this creature, whatever the heck it was that crawled out of her. I also really like the fact that it did seem, you know, as much as people are saying, oh, it's kind of like the smoke monster or whatever from Lost, I did like, and we saw this in Lost as well, but I did like the fact that there is a physical nature to it. It almost seemed like it had to grab Melisandre's ankles in order to keep pulling itself out of her. So that was very well realized. And that was one of the visual effects that I really had no problem with at all. I guess, you know, after you make a smoke monster, then everybody can figure out how to do it from there.
Right. Well, now, like, I was thinking about Lost a lot last night because I was thinking, now that's the origin of the smoke monster I really wanted, not some shiny cave. Because that origin actually made a lot more sense.
Yeah.
So, you're absolutely right. The shadow creature seemed to have some sort of corporeal essence to it, in the sense that, like you said, it needed to grab onto her ankles to sort of drag itself out of her womb, basically, I guess, which is so gross. But so that is super interesting.
Let me bring up another point about the whole kind of that whole last sequence, and that is we're kind of reaffirming where Stannis is in terms of seeing things in black and white, whereas the quote-unquote mating scene with Melisandre a couple of weeks prior had kind of made me wonder about his gray area. He's right down to even correcting Davos's grammar in this episode, which, again, I can see how that would make him, again, unlikable, as Renly says. I also wondered, it's just something that was stated between the two of them when they kept calling her the Red Woman. And then Stannis says, well, you know her name. I'm trying to think now. Have we actually, I mean, I know her name because of the HBO YouTube specials, but I don't know if I remember anybody actually calling her by her name in any of the episodes thus far. Do you recall if they have?
You know, that's a really good point. I'd have to go back and look at them, but there's a really good chance that you're right about that. And I'm trying to think in the book, I believe she was handled much the same way. I think she was often referred to as the Red Priestess or the Fire Priestess. And I don't think her name was often said even in the book, which actually adds this dimension of mystery to her character, right? Like, people don't even call her by her name for whatever reason. Like, maybe there's a reason why they don't.
Yeah. I unfortunately, the first thing I thought of after that thought occurred to me was, oh my gosh, we've got a Voldemort from Harry Potter, you know, the Red Priestess who must not be named or something like that. But I guess the fact that Stannis had said, well, she does have a name, that means it's okay to say it. It's just that they never do. I can see how that could be kind of a mystery. Just that mere fact makes me wonder if the statement of her name in a certain way could weaken her in some way or not. But that's, again, just pure speculation.
The interesting thing about Stannis is, you know, you get that great scene where on the ship with Davos where, you know, he sort of has presented himself, and he really is this sort of black and white, hard as iron. He will not bend. He will not break. He will not bend. But then in the same breath, he's sort of knowingly telling Davos that he's supposed to do a mission that he knows is a shortcut. he knows is a cheat. So where does that fit into his whole black and white world where people are either good or evil? So that makes his character really more interesting in a way that somewhere in his mind he's able to somehow compartmentalize these actions. So that was super interesting as well.
Yeah, very interesting. And even another thing I found interesting was the kind of mirroring of his black and white thoughts. And in the same way, Melisandre kind of took it a step further with Davos when they were in the boat, talking about, what was it she said, a half-rotted onion is still just a rotted onion, when she was talking about the good parts and the bad parts, and Davos saying it had both. That was pretty interesting to me as well. And I didn't know if that was the fact that she is subscribes to those some kind of beliefs. Yet here she is; she's willing to do this act as well, naturally, in order to fulfill Stannis's "quote unquote" destiny. So it puts her more or less in the same boat as she put Davos in, which is, again, is it the ability to compartmentalize all of it? That's a very fascinating character study there, Ken. Thank you very much.
Well, you see that all through history here in our world with fanaticism, especially religious zealotry. You see these people who either they're behind the Ten Commandments or they're behind the Quran or they're behind whatever religious beliefs they have, which seem like they're written in stone. But then often in the name of those religions and in their zealotry, they somehow allow themselves to do the most horrendous things to get what they want or to get to the point where they think they need to get to. So zealotry is always confusing to me. You know what I mean? Like, how do you justify, like, the ends don't always justify the means. So how in your own mind, especially if you consider yourself a religious person or a moral person, do you justify those sorts of actions? So
again, it's things like this that do make this world that these characters are living in seem much more real, I think, to us as modern day viewers, rather than just looking back at some kind of like Arthurian legend. You know, I think that's a great point to make. And with that, I'm going to bring in another caller here. We're going to be joined by Tim, a.k.a. Cortexy Junkie. Tim, welcome to the show, sir.
Good evening, guys. How's it going?
Doing very well. Thanks for calling in once again this week. Great to have you on.
Show's going well so far. I definitely like what Ken had to bring right there. I had similar notes about Stannis and Davos. You know, I thought it was kind of strange how he was making all those jokes right away, you know, kind of poking at his hand and then, you know, asking to do the things he, you know, feels that he's the most confident with, that his right-hand man sends him to do all his, you know, most important tasks. So I thought it was very interesting how that was contrasted there. Like, how can you be so morally correct on one hand, but then accept, like, that he used to be a smuggler and now you're going to use the smuggling to your advantage with that? It was very cool.
Very, very good observation, sir. How would you rate the episode on a scale of 1 to 10?
All right. Well, I just went over to the WordPress site. I voted, gave it an 8, but I bumped it up. You know, on here, I gave it an 8.75. It was closer to a 9, but I should have changed it to 9. But, yeah, it was a very good episode. As I was going through it, I bumped it up a little bit. I started at an 8. I watched it a second, and I gave it a little bit higher. You say it was a little rushed and a little misplaced. I did get that, and it kind of went with last week. That's kind of, you know, it was a little bit, some scenes that, you know, might not have been as necessary. I kind of felt that this week was a lot better than last week, though, and it also added to last week. And, it kind of would have been good as maybe one episode, 2-hour piece there, like just without the gaps, you know, it could have pieced it out a little bit better. But, it was very good. Very good episode.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, and that is the fact that now, since they are having to divide entire episodes with different storylines, it almost feels like sometimes that some of the dialogue has to be forced a little bit, just so that you can get through this, so that you can make sure to get back to the other storyline next week. Maybe that is part of the quote-unquote problem of adapting this book series to television. But the floor is yours, sir. Any points that we've brought up? I mean, you already addressed the Stannis thing a little bit, but feel free to expand on that or bring up any new points for us to talk about.
Well, I'm going to go to add on to that Stannis thing while we're there. I thought it was really smart sending Davos with Melisandre for this mission. There was a few reasons. The first, you know, because he trusts him and he figures that Davos will protect her no matter what because he asked him to. But then he also, that Davos knows all those shady shipping routes, so he was able to get her there. And then also because he's the only one really in his camp that doesn't believe in this religion stuff. So maybe Stannis knows there's going to be some kind of religion or mysticism happening, and maybe if you put Davos in that spot to see it, he'll get on board and it'll make his team so much stronger. I just thought that was very a lot of reasons that could you go to one with them.
That's a very good point, and I really liked Davos's reaction to the whole thing. I mean, fear and he just totally like backed away when he saw that starting to happen. And we'll see if that influences his belief in a god, so to speak, or if it just influences his belief in the existence of magic. I'm not sure. One thing I found interesting about Davos also was on the ship. He said, I think when Stannis asked him if his son listened to him about the kind of justice that Stannis had brought, he said, "Gods, no," which I'm assuming referred to the gods of the Seven, or the God of the Seven. And that seemed pretty interesting because just a couple episodes before, we'd basically heard Davos saying that Stannis was his god, that he didn't really believe in any of the gods. So maybe he was just using it in kind of a vernacular sense or in a slang sense. Kind of like a Westeros slang, "Oh, gods, no," you know, instead of like, "Oh, God, no." But it just struck me as a little funny and made me think about what you just said a little bit more, because if he does have any inclination towards the Seven, what will the witnessing of this event do for him in terms of his beliefs, if any? Ken, any thoughts on that?
I think it's an interesting point, and I think we'll have to see. I think Davos is pretty complicated, and I, in lots of ways, I think he's a surrogate for the audience, especially in your observations about the way that he reacted to the birthing scene, like, because that's what everyone, like, that's what I was doing when I was watching the scene. I was sort of freaking out, like, WTF? So that's great, and then I do think that probably a lot of it is just vernacular, kind of like Battlestar Galactica, where they would say things like that, whether they were super religious or not.
Okay. Yeah, that's what I suspected, but I just wanted to maybe see if somebody who had read the books might have a little bit deeper knowledge on it. But that's awesome. Tim, any thoughts about any additional thoughts about Davos there?
That was pretty much it. That's, you know, I had about Davos. So we didn't really get much with Davos, and obviously the Melisandre thing at the end was supposed to take us out of that right away and let us think what the hell is going on. But that was cool. I was waiting to see Jacob sitting there watching that whole thing.
We have a lot of Lost fans listening who are in this podcast or listening to this podcast, so they'll know exactly what you're talking about. In fact, I've already received several three-word submissions that involve, you know, smoke monster or man in black or things like that. So I definitely can see that. Excellent stuff, Tim. Another point about the show or anything else you want to talk about?
Yeah, it was it was gruesome. I love graphic stuff, and I mean, especially right off the bat, when they were doing that leg amputation, the sound of the saw, it was just it was so gritty. It was really cool. It added a lot to the whole attitude of the show. I like that stuff. I mean, it was evilness throughout the whole episode. Joffrey was just unbelievably evil this episode. That scene was right in the beginning with Sansa. He wasn't even messing around. He was just straight out being cruel. It was, you know, if Tyrion didn't come in, I don't even know what he would have done.
Yeah, I would agree with that too. I mean, obviously he wouldn't want to do. It still seems that he tends to respect his mother's wishes, so he wouldn't do too much to hurt her in a visible way, perhaps.
More the physical and mental torture. I mean, the mental torture rather than the physical torture. Like, that would have embarrassed the heck out of her in front of the whole audience of people that was standing there. You know, how can you, like Tyrion said, you got to think about her honor. She's going to be the queen one day.
I also really enjoyed the use, and this is something that almost everybody that we associate with as quote-unquote evil, it's a methodology that everybody that we associate as evil uses, and that is the propaganda. Using the squire, or not the squire, I guess now he's a knight, but the cousin Lannister to announce that some kind of sorcery was used to conjure wolves, and now the Northmen were eating the flesh of their victims and all of this stuff, you know, to further the, I guess, the image that the men of the North are much more evil than Joffrey himself, even as he is sitting there about to, you know, put an arrow through Sansa. I found that that dichotomy quite fascinating.
Yeah, they really added a lot of stuff to that was totally not true, especially right after we just saw Jon Snow talking about telling the other guy, no, we don't do this to these people. This isn't the way we do it from the North. And the guy told him, you're not in the North. He's like, no, we don't, torture. And they're not even going to torture him, let alone eat the flesh.
Exactly. Yeah. So it was kind of interesting there. Ken, any thoughts on that opening scene from King's Landing with Joffrey and Sansa and Tyrion?
Well, just a shout out to Sansa. I'm a Sansa lover, and I thought once again Sophie Turner hit it out of the park with her performance. And I especially love Tyrion's observation as he was following her out of the throne room, in which he said something like, "Lady Stark, you may survive us, or you will survive us yet." Sort of acknowledging her strength and acknowledging that she is capable in her own right. The way she uses politeness as a shield to protect her, like armor. And I think Tyrion was sort of acknowledging that in that line. And so I appreciated another character appreciating Sansa.
Yeah, I did too. In fact, I had that in my notes as well. Cheers to Sansa for keeping her cool and not admitting what she really wanted to Tyrion. That was spectacular. And Tyrion recognizes it, of course, just like you said. And then he says that she may survive us all yet, or something to that effect. It was fantastic.
She was playing the Game of Thrones right there. That was it. That's her, from her angle, that's how she has to play it.
Absolutely. I also like the fact that it was the Hound who brought her a cloak. That was nice. And again, it's all those little subtle things that I don't think that the Hound is supposed to be a likable guy by any stretch of the imagination. But the fact that I am a Sansa fan makes me appreciate him a little more right now. We'll have to see where that goes. But I do appreciate the fact that, it didn't seem like anybody else was going to offer anything. And it was Tyrion's request. It's not like it was Joffrey's request. So it's another case of him kind of standing against the king in a unnoticeable, quiet way, I suppose.
Yeah, but Joffrey was pissed. You saw the look on his face when he was walking out, because he couldn't even say anything. The whole floor was paying attention to them walking out, and he lost the whole attention of everybody. And he was just like, he was shocked. It was really well played. I mean, and Tyrion's lines, he's just so quick. When he gave Samoan that threat, he's like, and that's a threat. He's like, that. It was just so quick. It was very, very good. The Tyrion's character is phenomenal.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree completely. It's kind of funny to me that it was Bronn's suggestion that Tyrion took to give him that name day, that late name day present. But the fact that, I guess, that Tyrion had picked him out himself, that was one thing about Jack Gleason's performance this week that I absolutely loved. I mean, he is so good at making you hate Joffrey.
He's really good.
Yeah, that actor is doing a fantastic job. When he finds out that Tyrion had picked those two girls out himself, so to speak, that look on his face, the one of almost glee, like, this is how I can get back at my uncle. This is exactly, you know, it just was amazing. And kudos to that actor this week. You know, he's certainly not my favorite character, but as far as one of the child actors, well, I don't guess he's really that much of a child actor anymore. I think he's in his late teens or early 20s. But he just did a fantastic job at making me hate him this week. Well done.
Oh, yeah, he makes Malfoy look like Mickey Mouse. I mean, he's good. He's so good. He killed it, you know. And that scene when he was paying back his uncle, that was really, really tough to watch. But that was just mean. It was just straight evil. Like, he had no, he could have been with the girls like they first started. She, you know, pleasure her. He thought maybe like, all right, he's gonna be a teenage boy. He doesn't want any of that. He just wants to be pure mean and evil. And it's crazy because you wonder where that came from, because they come from the realm and, you know, they get everything handed to them. How he could be like that, it's crazy.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. He's just, I mean, we've seen since season one that he is simply just a spoiled, evil little kid, you know, in a way. And like Bronn had stated, you know, the kid's just sitting around plucking the wings off of flies, basically. Amazing. Ken, any other thoughts about either of those two scenes with Joffrey or with the whole Sansa, Hound, any of that?
Well, I actually think this is a case where the show is better than the book. In the book, Joffrey came off as a one-note character, to me anyway. And in the show, I think Jack Gleason is able, he's not bringing complexity to the role in the sense that he's gray. He is pure evil, but he is bringing layers of evil to his character. So to me, Jack Gleason is bringing a vulnerability and an insecurity to Joffrey, which I think really shades his character and in a way makes him more menacing. Like, there was that little quick moment where Roz greets Joffrey at the door and goes to reach for him, and he just sort of, he freaks out a little bit. Like, just like for a second, he seems so insecure about the fact that a woman is touching him. And then he quickly regains control over the situation by inserting violence into the recipe. But I really love what Jack Gleason is doing, that he's being evil, and he's pure evil, but he's also bringing, like, this shading in, like Tim was talking about, like, him still being slightly intimidated by his uncle, him being powerlessly upset by his uncle, and then the whole insecurity with the exchange with Roz, I think are really nice character moments for him.
Yeah, you get that whole impression of, especially when it's in regard to Tyrion and that, and even like what you just talked about, I almost get this, you're right, it does make, he is making Joffrey seem very fearful, because there's nothing more dangerous than a wild animal trapped in a corner. That definitely makes, you know, and any time that I think that Joffrey feels that his weakest is when he's going to lash out his most violent or his most evilly. And that was definitely apparent in that scene. Good point. Good point.
You could say, like, he's almost like a rat in a bucket that has fire held to it on someone's belly. That was more evil stuff. Yeah, I mean, it, this whole episode had just a lot of very good violent, but it was kind of necessary because it shows we had a lot of you know, we didn't see the good side. We didn't see any Jon Snow scenes with the good stuff. So we saw a lot of, like, bad stuff. Like, the next scene that, you know, when we seen Baelish talking to Renly, like, right after that scene, you know, with Joffrey there, we go over to the Baelish and Renly conversation, and, you know, right off the bat, Baelish is making shady deals that aren't even, don't even sound like they could be true. Like, he's offering Renly, yeah, maybe it could be possible that you could come in with to open gates. Like, how can he even offer that? Like, what is he implying? He's going to take out Joffrey or have that happen? Like, right off the bat, it's just, you know, maybe that wasn't so evil as far as violence, but this is evil because he's just making these shady deals. There's a lot of evilness and shadiness in this episode.
Absolutely. And in pertaining to that whole Littlefinger adventure, I really got the sense that we were seeing Littlefinger achieve the objectives from his perspective in order of importance, as opposed to the realm. He had naturally been sent there by Tyrion to make the deal with Catelyn. That was what he did last. You know, the first thing that he tried to do was to give himself a possible end with Renly in case Renly does win, to make him appeal, you know, at least, at very least, to save his own life. The next thing he does with Margaery is to, and I don't think this was to fish for information. I think that it's as far back as season one that you can tell that Littlefinger already knows about Renly and Loras. I think that he was actually trying to see discord between Margaery and Renly, because if Margaery and Renly's marriage fails, it's a possibility that the whole Tyrell clan may pull out of Renly's cause, rending Renly fairly weak and not much of a threat to the realm, in which case he gets to keep his position where he's at with the Lannisters, or the quote-unquote Baratheon reign. And the third thing was, in terms of his own order of priority, was, of course, to fulfill Tyrion's mission that he was sent on, and that was to try and make the exchange for Jaime Lannister with the girls, in which case he flat out lied to Catelyn after admitting that he totally was in love with her, which I found that was one of the things that I felt a little forced. A character as seemingly together as Littlefinger doesn't seem to me to be as much, it seemed to me that he would keep his cool about that very point for a little longer, rather than the it being the third sentence that comes out of his mouth after seeing her. Maybe I'm wrong.
No, he would have been way smoother with that. He would have dropped it like a little seed. He speaks in circles with everybody else. With something like that, you figured he would have at least dropped hints and planted a seed, like, you know, felt her out, how she was doing, if she was lonely with Ned. You're right, that would have taken a few episodes, but we don't have a whole book. We have 13 episodes that, you know, it's, I guess they have to do that to make it quick, to fit it in there.
My question is whether he would do it at all. That's a thing. I don't see that being a book thing or any other kind of reveal. I see that as being a forced character thing, not necessarily a time-shortening kind of thing, personally. Ken, any thoughts on any of the Renly camp sequences prior to Stannis and Renly meeting?
Well, two quick things. I agree with you. That was the one false note in the writing that I detected as well. So I agree with you and Tim about him declaring his love for Catelyn, like, within seconds of entering her tent. That did seem forced. I think what the writers wanted to convey, how I took it, is that the writers wanted to convey that she is his weakness. She is his kryptonite. But there was probably a more artful way to write that dialogue so that you got the same thing across without him just sort of clumsily declaring his love for her. And then the second thing was, when I think about Littlefinger, I always think about the Joker from the Dark Knight movie, whereas, you know, the Joker in that movie was sort of reinvented as this worshiper of chaos and this grand manipulator who like moves the chess pieces around. And that's what I always think about when I think about Littlefinger. I think about someone who loves chaos and someone who loves to move the chess pieces around the board.
Mm-hmm. So do you think that, because to me, he shouldn't have been fishing for information with Marjory. I think that's information he already knows. Do you think that perhaps seeding this discourse in Marjory or letting her know that he knows was, at very least, was part of that whole chaos-creating maneuver?
Absolutely. I took it exactly the same way, because there's no way that we as an audience member didn't think that he already knew about that. In fact, he made an allusion to it in the first season to Renly at the tourney. So we know he knew about it. So there's no other, I totally agree with you. In my mind, there's no other reason for him to have needled her the way he did without it meaning that he was just trying to sow discontent.
Right. I think he was trying to see if maybe she would get upset about that, and then he could use that to his favor and maybe even try to split them up. But I like that she knows. I like that she knows and she accepts it, and she doesn't care. She just wants to see Renly rise and make the baby so that they can have an heir to their throne when he becomes king, you know, in her eyes. And, you know, even in the beginning of the episode, where those guys were making the jokes about Renly being gay, it wasn't really about him being gay. It was more about him hiding the fact. I don't think anybody really cares, gay or straight. I think it's more of the games he plays, like hiding it. Like, nobody knows. But everybody knows. Like, it's no big deal.
But that's one thing, another thing that I had problem with the continuity between last episode and this episode, because Marjory and Renly are treating us like it's this great secret, when obviously to the entire rest of the realm, or at least anyone who's under the Lannister banner, and people like Littlefinger himself, already know this.
But that shows, that plays up to how everybody kisses the king's ass in some way or another. That's her way of kissing his ass, trying to let him know, because he probably has no idea that everybody knows. You know what I mean? Like, you know, the whispers and this and that. So he's thinking that, oh, nobody has any idea. He's just my number one knight, my sergeant at arms or whatever, you know, his title was. And he just thinks that everybody's expected to know he's with him all the time. So I think that it's kind of just playing, she's playing up to him, just trying to appease him. Like, oh, yeah, nobody knows. We'll keep it all secret. You know, that's what I took out of it.
Okay. In that case, then it's Renly's great miscalculation, which further disqualifies him in my eyes as being a good king.
Yeah, I think to a certain extent, everybody has their little skeletons that they think nobody knows about, but everybody knows about.
Well, I think that's definitely true of Renly, but I think Marjorie's working on a different level. I think she rightly or wrongly sees a certain sort of power in quote-unquote keeping up appearances. And I think there definitely is a certain degree of power in doing that. Even if it's an open secret and everyone is snickering behind your back, I think keeping up appearances is pretty important. And I think that's sort of the level that Marjory's working on. But I agree with you, Matt. I think that's a blaring failing on Renly's part, that he doesn't seem to be in on the joke. Like, I think he really thinks that it is a secret. So I think that speaks to his limitations.
Fascinating. I need to bring in another caller. Hang on a second. We have Methodic John, hopefully, will be next. John, are you with us, sir?
Yes, I am. Hello, all. Oh, yeah, you guys have been talking about all the good stuff. I was afraid I'd never get on it.
Horrible. I'm sorry for keeping you out of the loop. I wanted to make sure that all of the duties were attended to before we got to you. But feel free to talk about any of the subjects that we've already talked about, your viewpoints, what have you, after you give me a rating of the episode from 1 to 10.
I'll give it to you as an 8.
An 8. Particular reason why? Does this rate higher? See, it rates higher than last week's. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I believe that's correct. Excellent. You know, I just felt like I think the only reason it didn't get a higher rating is exactly some of the things you guys have already talked about. So I'm not gonna kind of go back to that, but you know, definitely felt like it was the timeline, as it were, was sporadic. It, you know, you brought up some really good points earlier about how it was jumping around. I found that a little awkward in watching it. But you know, all in all, you know, it was some good character dynamics unfolding.
I would agree with that for sure. I would agree with that for sure. This is your chance to talk about anything. If you have any different viewpoints about what we've been talking about, or feel free to bring up a new point, sir, if you wish.
I think, I don't think anyone's talked about the greatest city that ever was and ever will be, Qarth. I mean, Qarth. I mean, I'm curious, was that little mispronunciation that she made in the book, or was that something that they just wrote in for humor? I'm curious, anyone that's read the book.
I believe that was an invention just for the television show. In the book, she does meet a welcoming committee outside of the gate, and she does have a conversation with them. But I don't believe that particular line was in that conversation. So I think they just added that in.
Okay.
And that's another little bit of continuity that I had. I mean, I know I'm throwing Matt's tomatoes all over this episode, but when she's speaking to the scout in Dothraki, she pronounces it correctly. She calls it Qarth. Why would she suddenly say that? I mean, obviously this was a line written in for, I think, the audience's benefit, not only as kind of a little bit of a joke, but also to people who were looking at the map on the title screen, which we got Qarth and we got, what was the other one? We got Harrenhal on the title screen, on those titles this week, which to me, actually, both of those looked a lot better than some of the visual effects of them on the map. But nonetheless, I really felt like that was just to make sure that when we saw Qarth on the map, that we weren't pronouncing it Qarth ourselves as the episode went on, and that we would make sure to know what to call it the next time we heard it. And it was supposed to be funny, but it felt forced to me. All right, I'm done throwing tomatoes. Go ahead, John. I'm sorry. Go ahead with your point.
Oh, no problem. I thought that you kind of hit on the head. It was definitely a good match of tomatoes, I thought. I mean, here the guy says it like four times right in front of her, and, you know, she still botches it. It just seems, I don't know, I mean, kind of took down her character a little bit in my eyes. I mean, here she's so eloquent and, you know, verbose, you know, in many episodes past, and for her just to make such a slip, it's kind of out of character. But
Is it because maybe they're trying to, like, really play off the thing that they're hungry and thirsty and she's getting a little delirious from that? Or, you know, possibly that's a stretch. You know, I agree with what you guys are saying. I thought it was a little silly, you know, but that just getting that, like, I, you know, we didn't need that. We're not dummies. Like, we follow the rest of the show to a T, and all of a sudden this, like, hey, Qarth. No, it's Qarth. You know, like, come on.
Yeah. Tim, I would agree with that in the fact that I think there is a little bit more of a desperate nature to her, because now it is a matter of survival, and I don't discount that, but it still wouldn't. I just really don't feel like it would excuse the mispronunciation of a name after she had already pronounced it right a couple of times in the scene prior, which was supposed to happen 3 days right before. That's plenty of time to practice a name. And
she gets a plum tomato and a regular 4x6 tomato smashed right at her. That's it. Matt's tomato all over that.
But nonetheless, I do see your point, though, about how the fact that as the scene progresses, she does become more desperate, to where she even kind of resorts to sounding a little bit like her brother towards the end of that. And even unfortunately, that was even had to be kind of reinforced by the elder who was speaking to her by saying that was the first time she sounded like a true Targaryen. It also And maybe it was supposed to come across more, sounding a little more desperate than as an actual threat. But I really felt unmoved by that speech. I didn't fear her any more than any of those other elders still that feared her at that moment. Ken, any thoughts on Quarth? Did I say that right?
Yeah. It's like beating Danny's dead horse. No, other than I thought that was a nice introduction to Zorro, the African-American character who said he was from the Summer Islands, who sort of vouched for her and was the key to her getting into the city. I was glad to see him. And I was glad, I thought the actor did a good job.
I thought he did a good job too. The whole kind of loophole that they gave, that he used, whatever he incited, I can't remember what the term was now, but when he cut his hand, I was kind of sitting there thinking, well, that's a little Klingon blood oath like, but other than that, you know, that's just the geek in me just nitpicking. But nonetheless, he was a good actor. I felt the guy stands heads and shoulders above the rest of them, though, and I didn't see him until he stepped forward. I would have thought I would have noticed him better in some of the approaching shots, but maybe not. I just wasn't paying close enough attention, but it just seemed a little funny to me how he kind of showed up out of the blue. The Summer Isles thing obviously dictates that he was an outsider as well at one point. Let me put this to each of you, and this is just me kind of crazy theorizing, but does he see perhaps Daenerys and her dragons as a means to a different end other than just helping her? Or do you guys feel like she is, or he is more or less just helping out a kindred spirit who needed to be welcomed into the city? John, first.
Just a second. Kindred spirit, just kind of relating to her situation.
Okay. All right. Ken?
Well, just watching the scene, I would agree that he saw her as a kindred spirit. Of course, I've read the books, so I know. I know what happens to his character. But just if I just think about the episode and the scene, I would think that he sees her as a kindred spirit.
Very good. Tim?
All right. So now I thought the whole thing was like almost a setup. When someone wants to con you, they got to make you think it's your idea. So they all come there. Before they get there, he's telling them that it's the Garden of Bones. Anybody who goes in, then the garden gets bigger. Outsiders, right? So with the whole time, the spice trader is telling him, oh, forget it. If you're not going to show me the dragons, you can't come in. Obviously, that's all they really care about. They heard dragons. They want to see the dragons. They want dragons. So then he plays it like, nah, forget about it. You know, we don't want you. You take care. We greeted you. And then this guy steps up and makes her think like, oh, wow, he's going to change everybody's opinion. And it seems like almost like a setup just to get the dragons in there. I feel like that they want the dragon.
Ooh,
that's a
point.
Really good point. That's a great
good
point.
Good point. Good point. The long con.
Yeah, the long con. It's it. Some Sawyer style. Another lost reference.
Right on. Very cool. John, floor is yours again, sir.
The only other thing that you guys haven't beat to a pulp, in my opinion, was the youngest daughter, Aerys. Did I say that right? I'm sure I didn't. I'm horrible at pronunciation.
Arya, yeah.
Arya, yeah. I just found it rather interesting that, you know, Tywin, I guess, is not aware of, you know, the missing daughter and picked up that he was a she and that he, you know, considering how much she was staring at the swords there, you know, I guess she's probably going to be attempting to make a stab at Tywin in the future as his new cupbearer. I guess that's what we're all led to believe. I was just curious if everyone else who maybe hasn't read the book and or won't take the book in the context, their take on it was as well, you know, just as a observer.
Here's my two cents on that whole thing. I loved the irony placed in those scenes, because here you have Tywin, the smartest cookie, the one that figures out she's a girl right off the bat, yet he doesn't know that it's one of the girls that he's supposed to be finding, or that would help. As far as Arya and Gendry are both concerned, these are two big threats to the whole Baratheon plan. And he has them right under his nose, and he can't see them for the fact that they're right under his nose. That will probably – Tywin seems to be a pretty smart dude from what we gathered in season one. So I'm guessing that that's going to change and create some peril for Arya and Gendry, as if they're not in enough peril already, although his arrival did seem to stop the threat of the torturing, which was quite brutal. But I do think that it sets up for a nice irony here and a possible threat later. I'll let Tim go next.
All right. I threw a tomato all over that, because not what you said about that scene, because why would Tywin be so much smarter and more observant than every single person there and only pick up that she's a girl? She's all filthy now. She's not even as clean as she was with the other troop. And Gendry picked up on it. I got that. But nobody else that's with them even noticed that she's a girl. He looks at her for like 3 seconds. He's like, oh, God, you didn't notice that she's not a girl. That's why, because she's a girl. Like, that just, like, I don't know. I really didn't like that. I mean, I know they probably wanted to speed that up. I'm sure in the book it took a little longer. But I thought it was a pretty, you know, cool coincidence that she's going to be now with him as is, I forget what he said, some kind of maiden, cup maiden or some kind of maiden. Yeah, that was cool. I did like that whole, all the scene in the prison there. You know, I do have some questions later on about the prison scenes. But as far as the Tywin stuff, like, that was a little crazy. I just thought there was, why is he the only one? I was like, come on. I threw a tomato on my TV at that point.
Again, we have to, you know, I'm sorry we have to censor you in a way because of your book knowledge. So no real theorizing, I guess. But nonetheless, just your impressions of that scene with Tywin and such. Was it in the book? And how did you feel about it when you saw it?
It was in the book, and it played out very much the same way. So I guess I was prepared for that. And it sort of speaks, I think, to Tywin's character more than anything else, that he's like 3 steps ahead of everyone else, and that he's super smart, and that he's sort of like Sherlock Holmes, and he has this like massive power of deduction, and I think you could probably infer that from him realizing that Arya is a girl. But the other thing about it, though, is that all of the characters are spread out at this point over all of Westeros and Essos. And so one of the joys is when characters come together, like characters that you would never think would come together because it's wartime and people are traveling all over the place. And so I love that this was an introduction to the concept that characters that you wouldn't think would cross paths are going to cross paths. And it's ironic that he's sort of a bad guy, but his very presence saves her, saves Gendry's life, because he stops the torturing. And he didn't do it out of the goodness of his heart by any stretch of the imagination, but by saving Gendry and making Arya his cupbearer, I thought that was a really cool twist, and it makes her an intimate of his, so that she's going to be in the room with him, you know, serving him his wine and bringing him his water. And I just think that that's a cool twist.
Oh, especially if he eventually crosses paths back with Cersei or someone who knows what she looks like, she's going to be right there. I definitely like what's going to come with that. That was cool that they're together. I just thought, you know, the whole part with him noticing she's a girl immediately was a little crazy. But yeah, definitely, that's cool. That's going to be fun.
Yeah, and I subscribe to the thing that I see it more as a metaphoric irony than anything other than, you know, that's one of those things that I actually didn't throw a tomato at because I saw it in a different context, I guess. But yeah, good points. While we're on the subject of Harrenhal, so to speak, let me bring in Steve friggin' Italian as well. But John, any other points about Harrenhal you want to make, and then we can put it to Steve first, and then get his thoughts about the episode as well.
One last general question to everyone else, and this is just morbid curiosity. Anyone that hasn't read the book having any difficulty at all keeping track of names and figures and people and places? Because my wife was even commenting, she's like, I'm just lost in season two. And I said, you know, definitely is more confusing than season one. I'm just generally curious, is everyone able to follow everything along perfectly, or are they finding it a little bit more difficult?
I will say that I have to do homework. You know, a lot of my knowledge actually came from a lot of the official YouTube channel of the Game of Thrones in terms of learning characters' names kind of in advance because they did several character bios and that kind of thing prior to the beginning of season two. Now I'm not having so much of a difficulty. You know, if I see Harrenhal on the map, I figure we're going to see Harrenhal this week. And I log the name pretty quickly. If I'm seeing other names, and here's a name that we didn't hear really since season one, The Mountain. Well, a new actor has been cast for him because the old actor, I think, had to go play on The Hobbit or whatever. So we have a new actor playing, quote unquote, the Mountain, who is the Hound's brother. And he's a much different looking dude. So that kind of took me out of that whole sequence of events as well, just a little bit, trying to get used to the different actor and trying to remember that he is the Mountain. But yeah, it's definitely difficult, John, for me, it's just in terms of, you know, doing a little extra homework, which one would think one shouldn't have to do for television shows, but it's very hard to get you invested in characters that are on screen for like 5 minutes and then gone, you know, for three episodes. It's tough to do. I understand that completely. Tim, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, actually. I, last year, was finding myself calling a lot of people, like, oh, that guy with the silver helmet and that guy, you know, with the short guy and the imp, until, you know, finally got comfortable with the main character names. But there were a lot of characters. This year, I knew the podcast was going to start coming on. I wanted to really get more involved, so I actually had to do my homework. And I enjoy it that much more. I went on, there's a wiki for Game of Thrones that breaks down a lot of characters, and then I use IMDb a lot because it put the faces right next to the name and then the character's name. So I printed out a couple the pages of IMDb of the lists, and then when we did the first show, Mariana, I met her in the chat, and we started talking back and forth. She actually sent me a couple family trees and maps. So I started looking at that. I printed them out. But it does require homework, this show, to know names. Otherwise, you know, to talk in the podcast, you kind of do need to know the names. If you're going to talk amongst a couple of friends at work, maybe, you know, you might be able to get away with saying, you know, that guy who was Cersei's dad, you know, was in this episode, or, you know, and things like that. But, you know, it does require a little homework. I did have to do some. I found IMDb helps a lot because you could break it down by episode, and then they'll just show you who was in that episode. But sometimes it's not every character. But then you can do the whole overall show, and it'll show you, you know, this guy's in 12 episodes, 13 episodes, and you can know that they're a little more prominent characters, so maybe you want to know the names more, you know, first. Just some tips I have.
I, for one, you know, went back and watched the Karth scene like three or four times to make sure I got that large guy's name right. And the first time, a couple times I listened to it, it sounded like Zanozaro Duck Sauce.
I got the perfect solution. I did the same thing last night. I rewound it, and then I turned closed caption on. Closed caption came on. They spelled the guy's name out right away. I was like, yes, and I wrote it down.
Ah, yep, good point. Yeah, I've since have gotten Zaro Duck Sauce or something.
It was like
three
words, the guy's name.
Yeah, Zaro's, let's see, Zaro's or Zaroxandoxos or something to that effect. Frigg and Ken can't really talk about the name tracking since they have read the books, I'll let Steve chime in. How do you say that guy's name at Karth?
Zaroxandoxos.
All right. See, there you go. It's that simple when you read the book. You just know.
Yeah. That name, Danny gets to meet a lot of people with weird names, and that's one of the easier ones.
Oh, lovely. That's nice to
know. Yeah.
I think I'll just call him Duck Sauce from now on, personally.
There you go, that's, Duck Sauce. I like that.
That's why Spice Trader works.
Very good. Steve, yep. Welcome to the show. Sorry to keep you out for so long.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
First of all, your rating of the episode on a scale of 1 to 10, sir?
I actually gave it a 9. I was taken out a couple times by certain little scenes and certain little aspects of scenes, but for the most part, I really, really like this episode because when it's shown brightly for me. And all I can say is the smoke monster's back.
The smoke monster's back. Excellent. Excellent. Well, good. That's a good rating. I mean, between you know, all of us, we're still rating it right between an 8 and a 9, which is certainly a good episode fairing in terms mm-hmm. of its rating. I know we've talked about a whole lot before you got on the podcast, but is there anything that we have talked about that you would like to address your own viewpoints on or that you would like to expand upon or maybe bring up a different point?
A couple of things. Right off the bat, I noticed, you know, end of the episode, I was a little surprised that it ended. It seemed like it came pretty quickly to me. I guess it was, you know, that much of a good sign of being a good episode. But I noticed there was no John, no Greyjoy story, and no Cersei at all. And that was a little disappointing because I would like to have a little bit of all three. What else was there? The gentleman that was speaking to Rob at the beginning of the episode, he's the one who said, a naked man has few secrets, a flayed man has none. That character's name is Roos Bolton. And he's a pretty tough character. That's all I can say about that. And I know anybody who's read the books definitely knows what I'm talking about. And he's definitely somebody to keep an eye out for. I don't know if you noticed, but Arya, when she lays down to sleep at night, she does a little prayer that that Yoren kind of more or less told her about. And so she announces everybody she wants dead. And so she went through this whole list. It started with Joffrey, Cersei, the Hound, Ellen Payne, and the Mountain. And by the end of the episode, she'd added Polliver. Polliver's the one that's carrying her sword, Needle. He's the one that, you know, also came around like picking people to come out and be tortured.
Oh, okay. All
yeah,
right.
So she added Polliver at the end of her little prayer at night. And then there's that one guy that was asking all the questions. They call him the Tickler, which they didn't actually say in the episode, but I'm hoping they will soon. He's definitely not on her favorite list either.
Yeah,
for obvious reasons.
Why. let's talk about that a little bit, because the whole Arya thing with her reciting these names, I think we talked a little bit about this, or last week, some of y'all said, well, this is kind of setting up her whole kind of revenge trip, Arya's kind of, you know, trip of revenge. And we are seeing that in the fact that she's not going to forget the names of the people, you know, that she's not just going to remember the faces, but she's also going to remember the names of the people with whom that she is going to take her. Yeah, that was a great seed and kind of let you know where Arya is going. It'll be interesting to see how Tywin gets how being with Tywin influences that one way or another, or expedites or slows down that kind of quest. We'll have to see. Nonetheless, I think that was an important part of the story, and it did kind of actually it resonated with me to the point where after a conversation with Jamalama, also known as MM Jamalama on Twitter, brought me to my three words. But before I get to any of that. We still have more Game of Thrones to talk about. What else have you got for us, Steve? Or first of all, before I do that, let's go to Ken, because we haven't heard from him in a while. Your thoughts about the whole Arya name recitation. I don't know how you say that.
Prayer.
Litany of words. yeah, no, I thought it was a beautiful character moment for her, and it was a progression of the suggestion that she got from last week. So in a way, it seemed like this beautifully natural progression for her character to start muttering the people that she hates as sort of a prayer to help her sleep at night. And that's one of the things about this story, is it's super complicated, but then when you have those little character beats like that, it almost doesn't matter if you know her name or if you know the name of the castle that she's at. I feel like you can still get sucked into just about every scene, just based on the emotions of the scene. And they're so compelling, and the characters are so complicated and likable or dislikable, or so that was, I just thought, one of many, you know, really great character moments of the episode.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that, including as far as Arya is concerned. I love the fact that she matched wit toe-to-toe with Tywin in a way, because he asks, why are you dressed as a boy? And she quickly comes off with, you know, it's safer to travel that way. I love that. You know, I mean, she thinks about that. She was able to think about that, whether it was something that she had been thinking about and rehearsing. I don't know. But nonetheless, she was able to pull it off convincingly enough to Tywin to where it impressed him. It impressed a smart man. So that's very cool. Let's go to John and your thoughts about Arya as well and her kind of recitation of names.
You know, I just thought it was kind of foolish. I mean, she's doing it out loud. It sounded like it looked like her lips were moving to me, so it sounded like that was saying something she was saying out loud, which I kind of thought would be dangerous. But maybe I'm overthinking it.
That's a good point, actually. I think that is a good point. I don't know who... she does have that... She does have that moment where she is reciting them and that guard comes by does he stab the woman or does he just hit her? I can't remember. But, yeah, I can see your point there where that would be dangerous. I hearken back to, I think, what was really a good characterization of Arya in that she has more courage than sense sometimes. And I think that was one of the gentlemen in the cage that said that at the beginning of episode 2, maybe. So I felt like it was within character, but I agree with you that it's very, or it's not very smart. Tim, any thoughts on that?
I loved it. I thought it was terrific. You know, I liked how the second time around they added the two names because she started realizing that, wow, these people, you know, the mountain, he just punched this girly in the stomach. They added the mountain to the list. And I think that that's really developing her character so well. Like, I love her. I think she's going to, you know, I said it in the past few episodes of the show, I think that she's going to be a really, really strong figure in the stories come, you know, later on. And reciting what she learned and taking everything she learned from everybody. And last week, you know, she got this from Yoren, and it was so tragic what happened right after she heard that story, that I guess it really stuck with her. And now that she's starting to develop like this vengeance towards people. But as we were talking about it before, as Steve came on, as he said that, you know, brought up Yoren, I started to think about all those father figures. Now, Tywin did the right thing. He stopped the torture of Gendry right when it was about to get rough. And he kind of took a liking to Arya that, now maybe is he going to be the father, next father figure that gets killed? That's kind of a theory I'm planting the seed for.
Interesting. I know book readers probably can't comment too much on it.
Yeah, please don't.
Yeah, don't worry.
But yeah, you know, I like it. It makes you think about a lot of stuff, and you know, those names, like, what is she going to do about that? Is she going to get Needle back and just put Needle through all those people? Or is she going to set it up? Is she going to play Game of Thrones once she gets to somewhat of power, wherever she gets, and takes all these people out by the Game of Thrones without using violence? So she might learn. She might learn something from Tywin.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I was just going to say, you know, if she does end up kind of taking Tywin on as yet another father figure, what might she glean from that time? And that would be very interesting to see her development of the character after this time period, if there is an after this time period. We don't know.
He's like,
as she said in the promos, anyone can die, which I guess doesn't exclude her either, although I'm sure book readers could comment one way or the other on that, but we won't have any of that. Great stuff. Let's see, Steve, go ahead, sir, with your next point.
Let's see, what else was there? I really like the scene between Kat and Peter Baelish. I thought it was very well shot, very well acted, when he brought Ned's remains to her. I really felt her pain, actually, you know, and how infuriated she was with him, but also saddened by the fact that she's finally got her husband's remains back. I thought she, above all, you know, did a fantastic job of acting in that scene.
I would agree with that. Michelle Fairley gave a really good performance this week. Not only did I feel, you know, the pain and the anger of it all, but the strength of her character throughout. Even that scene with Stannis and Renly facing off, you know, and she kind of becomes the mother figure. Says, if I was your mother, I would bash both your heads together and put you in a bedroom till you remembered you were brothers. I love that. I mean, Catelyn is a very strong woman, and she's very well executed in this series to me. Or she's very well executed as a strong woman in this. And even before she breaks down in that scene, you know, after opening the chest, she makes sure to throw Baelish out of there so that he can't see that weakness. I thought that was a very strong maneuver as well. Although Baelish does get one stab in there to her, and that is that of her children. That is obvious. But of course, you know, you would expect that. In terms of her reaction to that revelation. So I didn't have any problem with that at all. It didn't take her out of the character of being strong. It actually reinforced the strengths that she did have. How about John? Any thoughts on that?
I do agree that the Littlefinger's timing and delivery was a little... almost unbelievable that he would be so selfish to kind of flirt with her while I'm assuming there's his head was in the box. Is that, I mean, did we ever get a definitive what was in the box?
No, his remains. I'm not exactly sure what all that consisted of.
I assumed ashes.
Yeah, I didn't know what.
That was just his remains. They didn't really clarify if it was like ashes or his bones or what. But I'm kind of curious myself. But I was just inferred with it was just his remains, and they didn't really elaborate any further.
Yeah. But she gave a great delivery, and you know, it was very, very believable. But I don't know, Littlefinger just is. It was almost out of character for how shrewd he is to kind of deliver a kind of clumsy hand like that. But that was just my take.
Yeah. I think those are valid points. We did discuss earlier how perhaps it's to signify that Catelyn is Lord Baelish's one weakness, but like we've all agreed, I think it was a bit overplayed, could have been played a little bit differently. And that I blame on the script more than the actors, of course. Let's move on to Tim real quick with any thoughts about the Catelyn Lord Baelish scene?
Next to Arya, Catelyn's my favorite character on the show. You know, Arya's my number one, but Catelyn's right under her. She's so strong, and I brought up a couple weeks ago, I said, why, you know, a few people, everybody keeps forgetting about Winter, and she brought it up. She's like, you know, like you said, well, I'm going to bash you guys' heads in. They got more important things to worry about. She's trying to unify everybody, you know, and I was very surprised, jump real quick to the beginning of the show, when Jon Snow talked about he doesn't even fight to take the crown. He's just fighting for what's right. So what Catelyn's doing now is she's just trying to unite these guys to figure out who's going to be the proper king to go over and overthrow Joffrey and take over the realm with the backing of all these parties. And she seems like the one, the mother hen who's looking after everybody and knows. She has that foresight. And I love her character. I think she's great. And this scene, you know, when she got Ned's remains back, it showed a little bit more of her emotional side. You know, like she's very strong with those other scenes, but now she gets Ned's remains, and now she could tell Baelish, go to hell. You lied to me. You know, you helped have my husband killed. Get the hell out of here. And then she was strong at that point, and then was very, very emotional. She's awesome. She's a terrific character. She's such a great actress.
I would agree. Ken, your other thoughts on that particular scene, Catelyn in general?
I agree with you. I think Michelle Farrelly just hits it out of the park. And I also agree with Pam. She's also one of my favorite characters. And she, like he said, she just sort of exudes this motherly common sense. And it's so refreshing with all of these big bombastic male characters to see her come in and just sort of see things clearer in a way than anyone else. And she sees things more directly. And I appreciate that about her character. And I also think she's a great counterpoint to Cersei, because here are two mothers who have sort of power in their own right, sort of, but they exercise that power completely differently. I've always appreciated how Kat is a counterpoint to Cersei, in her sensibility, in her maternal instincts. Yeah, she's a great character.
Fantastic. Steve, any final thoughts on that or another point you want to bring up?
The only other thing I can think of that wasn't brought up yet was that little exchange between Tyrion and Lancel. I thought was really well done. Lancel being his cousin, and you know, he kind of pretty much calls him out, you know, saying, "Oh yeah, I know how you got your knighthood." Because remember, he was the one who was the squire, cupbearer, or whatnot for Robert, and now suddenly he's a knight, and he's all, you know, he's really big headed about it, and then Tyrion kind of really puts him in his place and calls him out on how he got to where he is now. And I thought that scene was just fantastic.
Agreed, totally. In fact, in terms of the stuff that was a little bit more humorous as well as powerful, that was one of the scenes that played best for me this week. I love the fact that he was placed there. I'm taking it by Tywin originally, in order to do the queen's bidding or whatever, even though he was serving under Robert. And that puts a whole new layer of Tyrion thinking, because he's able to give up. He's achieved. To me, it was a multiple layered plan. It wasn't just to get rid of Pycelle as a possible mole, but it was a way to get closer to Cersei, or at least it played out fortuitously for Tyrion in that way. He was able to capitalize on the, I guess, the fallout from all of that very easily with Lancel. And so he's actually even more on the inside now than he was before. And I think that serves his purpose, even if it be for nothing more than survival, which is what I can see right now. I'm sure as we've discussed before, Tyrion does have a moral compass, but I think that he doesn't want to die any less than any other man. We've seen that demonstrated time and time again in season one and in this season. So now he has yet another card in his deck, so to speak, which he can pull out at any time. Let's go to Ken for thoughts on this real quick.
I thought it was great. A lot of the dialogue was lifted exactly from the book, from their scene. And I think Martin doesn't get acknowledged often as a great dialogueist, but he does write great dialogue. And a lot of that dialogue was lifted right from the book. And just sort of his dressing down of Lancel, his powers of perception, the way he's able to, like you said, capitalize on the fallout of putting Pycelle in the black cells last week and get even closer to Cersei. So, because now Lancel's like a double agent, right? So who will be reporting back to Tyrion anything he hears or sees. So I thought it was another great Tyrion moment of him consolidating his authority in King's Landing.
Excellent. Jim, anything to add on that?
I love the scene. Tyrion, he's just so smart. He knows, you know, just how to play everything, and the character's written so well, and he acts it out so well. I mean, Peter Dinklage is incredible. But I can't really add too much to that. It was good. It was really good.
Very good. And John, anything else to add on that, or confirmation of anything we said?
Nope, you guys covered it pretty good.
Very cool. So I like the fact that Ken brought him up as kind of like a double agent. Unfortunately, a double agent does have kind of a danger to it of itself, and I won't pose any kind of like theory or make anybody who's read the books confirm it, but could this not possibly be just as much as of a disadvantage to Tyrion as it is to Cersei? I mean, I know that he has this big secret that he can throw at Joffrey at any time, which probably will keep somebody like Lancel in check. But with this, as many flips and turns as we've seen of allegiances and everything, I can never call it the fact that anybody can be in any just one singular person's pocket at any time for whatever reason. Am I just absolutely crazy in thinking things like this, or is that what we're supposed to do as viewers of this show?
I take it like that. I mean, I think you're right on. That's what we're supposed to think. You know, like at any, you know, any moment, anything can happen in the show. And any moment, anybody could get caught with their pants down, so to say, and form an allegiance with somebody else, or have to cover up blackmail and report like this kid's going to have to do. I think, you know, it's great. It's perfect. So well written.
John?
One question I had is, you know, at the end when Tyrion makes that comment, you know, I can't say I didn't hurt him. I was just curious, you know, maybe I missed something, but why did that?
Because he cut his beard off. Remember he said...
I remember the cutting the beard off. Why is that
a
big deal?
He said to him, you better not have harmed the hair on his head. And he goes, well, I might have. It's kind of a joke, kind of humor.
Yeah, I thought last week somebody said something like that he'd never cut his beard ever, or I don't know if I heard that somewhere. I can't remember anymore.
Yeah, that was me.
Okay. Yeah. Is that like symbolic in the show, or just more like he's never cut it?
That was something that just he did, because it's not a Maester thing, because as we know, Maester Luwin doesn't have a beard, but that was just a Pycelle thing. He always took, the way I remember it, he always took pride in his beard. Even though it was kind of, for the show, it looked kind of scraggly to me, he was really prideful about his beard, about how, you know, how long it was and how well grown it was, so getting it cut off was a big deal for him.
Okay. All right. I took it as the beard reference and more of a joke than anything else. Although, like you just stated, Steve, it's probably more or less of a joke to Picel himself. Yeah, definitely. Very cool. Very cool. Who have I not spoke to about this scene? Have I spoke to everybody? We'll take the crickets as a speaking to everybody. Okay, we're moving on then. I'm coming up on a minute or an hour 41 minutes here. So wow. We're going to wrap up our discussion of the episode itself and start asking the really tough questions. You guys know what
like
those are.
Three words.
Been on here yeah, we're going to ask the really tough questions like three words and brothel mates of the week. I will give you guys my three words first. Again, this comes from M.M. Jamalama as the inspiration. I have to credit her for this because we were actually conversing about The Mountain and the fact that the actor had changed. She mentioned to the fact that she liked the fact that The Mountain had been added to Aria's hit list. And so those became my three words.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I really liked it. So thank you again, Estes, for those wonderful three words. And another one that I came up with, and this again is more about my Matt's Tomatoes than anything else, was that the script felt forced. So those are my three words. Why don't we start with, let's see, Ken, you go first on this.
I will take gloom, doom, and baby-smoke monster.
Gloom, doom, baby-smoke monster. Run on word. SkyTweet would be proud if she were here right now. Excellent. All right. I don't think that needs any... explanation, actually. That's pretty good. How about John? You next, sir.
I was kind of, my take was more like monsters are everywhere. Baby.
Ooh.
Monsters. Joffrey definitely came out as a monster. You know, some interesting, quote, monsters kind of coming to the surface.
I really like that. Monsters are everywhere. That's excellent. Let's see. Tim, you go ahead, sir.
I have pain spoils pleasure. It was said during the scene when Joffrey had the two women, the one woman beating the other woman, and she says, Joffrey, too much pain spoils the pleasure. And it kind of rode throughout this whole episode because wherever there was a good scene, it was just pow. The next scene was something nasty like the rat going through the guy's belly and different scenes like that, and I liked it. Pain spoils pleasure.
That's very good. And Steve, you're last on this one, sir.
Smokey is back.
Smokey is back. We got a lot of smoke monster references this week. Like I said, there's a bunch of that I've already been tweeted for three words as well. Excellent. How about the brothel mates of the week? I'm going to let Tim go first so that he has a choice whether to change his or not since we had the same one.
Oh, now I'm on the spot. I really didn't think about another one. I had Joffrey and his crossbow.
They did.
He loved that crossbow, didn't he?
He definitely liked to use that thing or to have it at his side. Every appearance in this episode. I like that very much. John, you're next, sir.
Sansa. Wow. She really had a rough go there, didn't she?
Yeah.
Joffrey. I know you guys are good. Some people out there are having like a little heart attack that I just said that, but you know, had to have fun with it.
Very good. Very good. All right. Then how about Steve?
Mine's a three-way. It's Davos, Melisandre, and Smokey.
Oh. All right. That's fantastic. And Ken, sir?
I will present the Disney choice this week and say Arya and Gendry.
Yeah, very nice. She did display some concern for Gendry when he was being taken away. That was That's very cool. I'm going to go kind of along the lines of friggin' Italian. I'm going to change mine, Cortexy, since we gave you and I had come up with the same thing. I'm going to go with Melisandre and her obstetrician. that would probably be the lantern, you know, either that or her pendant, whoever helped in, you know, in the birthing of the baby. But yeah, we'll just say the obstetricianist, Lord of Light, I guess. That'll be mine, because that was definitely a scene that, while powerful, made me happy not to be a father. Anyway, fantastic. We'll go around the room and give everybody a chance to plug themselves wherever they are on the interwebs, give any final thoughts about the episode. We will start with Ken, since you were first on.
You can find me at Facebook at Ken Lopez, and thought it was a great episode. Thought it was a really super dark episode, but I thought that was needed, because I think that you need to understand that war is damaging and hurtful and unpleasant and all of those things. And you definitely saw a lot of people in pain this week. So, yeah, really liked it.
Very good, Ken. And thanks again so much for calling in. Your voice on this podcast is, like I said, you've become a podcast fan favorite. So thanks again for calling in.
Thanks.
And let's go with Steve next. How can people find you on the interweb, sir?
Well, you can find me on Twitter as Friggin' Italian, and that's FRIGGEN, and as well as on VU. I'm under the same name.
Very cool. Final thoughts about the episode?
One last thing is I really loved how they showed Harrenhal. I mean, it's exactly how I pictured it from the book, with the melted stone and everything. It was absolutely gorgeous.
Interesting. All right. I haven't read too much about Harrenhal, so I don't know what it's supposed to look like. Again, I had problems with the matting. It's not necessarily the CGI models. It's the matting of it. It's the blending of it that always kind of takes me out of the moment, and
yeah.
makes me feel like I'm looking at a mill production. I understand, you know, there are different visual effects companies kind of competing this season for a permanent position with the production, and the only thing that does for me, though, and you would expect every team to do its best. But some teams' bests are going to be better than other teams' bests. And I think my problem throughout the whole season has been maybe not necessarily the work of the companies themselves, but the frames that they have to deal with in order to try and blend the focusing. As soon as we saw Arya and Gendry and them walking and looking back at Harrenhal there, I was just like, ooh. Oh, I feel like it's the doctor's wife from last year on BBC. It just didn't feel all that real to me. It felt like it didn't feel green screen per se, but it just didn't blend right for whatever reason with the foreground stone. The background stone seemed different, which you would expect if it had been melted and burned, of course, by dragonfire. But nonetheless, it just didn't seem like they were in the same place to me.
Yeah,
that was. But the model itself, though, I thought looked okay on its own. You know, if I blocked out the foreground and looked at it, then I thought that the model itself looked fine. Yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, That's kind of what I was thinking. To be honest, I wasn't paying attention to the foreground. I was just stuck on that background scene. So yeah, I do see what you mean, going back and looking at it. And so yeah, it does kind of seem out of place. But the structure itself, if you ignore the foreground, it did to me look really good. It looked really fantastic.
Right on. And I really enjoyed the map depiction of it myself personally. I thought that was cool.
Yeah.
Any thoughts on the CGI this week? I know that I've been really picky about it because I'm a guy that expects a production of this quality to be of that quality in every aspect, I suppose.
The only problem I had was when we saw Grey Wind at the very beginning.
Mm-hmm.
That really just took me out of it because it was a great scene otherwise. It was building up really well. I mean, they cracked jokes about Loras and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, you know, he's like Reddick or whatever the guy's name was, and all of a sudden you just see a close up of Grey Wind. It's like, okay, that just seemed kind of out of place to me.
Yeah, to be perfectly honest, I'm doing this from memory because I haven't looked back at episode one, but it seemed like the fur coloring was slightly different, even just from what I remember in my mind, because I have that image of Rob holding on to Grey Wind as he's talking to Jaime Lannister stuck in my head. But maybe it was because of quote unquote the light of the night or what have you, or the light at the camp when he was talking to Jaime. But I just kind of almost felt like the coloring was off from and incontinuous from episode one. Does anybody else, John or Tim or anybody, have any thoughts on the CGI this week, or am I just nuts?
You're nuts.
Yeah, I think you looked at it a lot closer than I did. I was really engaged in the story, and it was moving so fast that I really didn't have – and I watched it twice. There was a couple of scenes I paid attention to, and I kind of liked it, but nothing that I, like, really noticed that took me out of it or anything like that. I did like the prison scenes. I thought they looked pretty authentic. But other than, you know, I didn't really pay attention as much as you did.
John?
I just was busting your chops. Yeah, I agree, Tim. I didn't notice.
Cool. Ken, since Steve had talked about how Harrenhal, just kind of the image of it, lived up to his mind perspective, how did you feel about that? Did it live up to what you had pictured when you read the book?
Yeah, it definitely did. Both Harrenhal and Karth, I thought the matte inlay looked really, really good. In fact, I don't know if I was so invested in Daenerys just being hungry and her people being so pathetic, but when they opened those gates and you saw how pretty the city was, I thought, oh, that just looks like heaven. That looks like the best city ever.
It looked just like Naboo. I thought I was going to win for Amidala to come out.
Yeah, Tim and I were joking. And I was like saying, oh, yeah, I kept expecting Jar Jar Binks to be one of the 13.
Yeah, I mean, even the spice trader, he looked like the king of the Gungans. Like, I think it was funny.
Very cool. Very cool. John, it's sorry to keep you holding, sir. How can we find you on the interwebs? And any final thoughts about the episode, sir?
I am on Twitter, MethodicJohn, one word. This is just quirky me, but it's hard to look at Charles Dance, a.k.a. Tywin, and not think of his role in Last Action Hero as Benedict. I don't know if anyone else remembers and saw that.
Oh,
movie.
Yeah. He wasn't that.
I just. Yeah.
He's aged. He has aged really well. I mean, he still looks pretty darn good. And Last Action Hero was what, in the late 80s? I want to say, or early 90s?
Yeah, it was early 90s. I always think of him in that movie with the Eddie Murphy, with the Golden Child. He's the bad guy with the cloak, with the big leather jacket.
I'm sorry, John. What were you gonna? I heard you trying to talk in there. What else were you saying?
I was just acknowledging in the comment about Golden Child.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah. To be perfectly honest, I didn't recognize this actor from anything else. That might kind of clue you all into how few movies I watch, or even how much television I actually watch. Nonetheless, I from moment one that I saw him in season one, I have accepted him as just Tywin Lannister. Now I'm going to have to IMDb, search him and find out what else he's been in so that I can go, oh, yeah, he's that guy from there. And, oh, yeah, he's that guy from there. But
I would think of Alien 3.
Yep, he was.
Wow. Yeah, I just haven't seen. Why would anybody watch Alien 3?
Bigger question is, why would anyone watch Last Action Hero?
it's so bad it's good, that's why.
Exactly.
Guilty pleasure movie, there you go.
Yeah, exactly. That's what it is, it's one of those.
very good. Who haven't I gotten to here? Let's see, Steve, Ken, John, Tim.
Yes?
How can people find you on the interwebs and last thoughts about the episode?
You can hit me up on Twitter, Cortexy Junkie. Or here on Monday nights, I'm either in the chat or I'm on the call. And Sunday night, don't bother me while I'm watching Game of Thrones. That's all I got to say. But it was a good episode overall. We've covered just about everything tooth and nail, except for one thing I had a question on. Maybe you guys could just refresh me if I forgot. When they were torturing the guys, they kept asking about the Brotherhood. What exactly is the Brotherhood?
That might be spoilery.
Okay, it's something that we haven't really got into yet, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
I know we saw that one scene when those guys were at the blacksmith last year and they rescued him. I think that's what they were referring to when the guy got tortured, right? Am I right or wrong with that?
I don't follow which scene you're talking about.
I kind of forget. I'm sure it's sketchy. I haven't watched it in a while. There was a scene last year where we saw like a blacksmith help somebody in the woods. Did he get sort of taken for a fall or something like that? I might be mistaken, but all right. So we didn't really see the Brotherhood, though, correct?
No, that's correct. We have not seen the Brotherhood yet.
All right. Okay. Very good. That was pretty much, I picked up on that. I was just a little curious because I'm like, they keep asking about this Brotherhood. What the hell is the Brotherhood? And I guess it's another faction we'll learn about.
Excellent, excellent catch. Something to look forward for in
yep.
the future. Very good. And with that, we're going to wrap up this podcast, and hopefully we will hear from you next week as well. If you want, at 9 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, simply call 724-444-7444. When asked for a call ID sign, just dial 11-8884 and the pound sign. And then if you're already a TalkShoe member, you'll be added to the call most likely automatically, or it may ask you for a PIN number. If you don't have your PIN number available, it's very easy to just dial 1 and the pound sign, as Ken did tonight, and you will be added to the call. I take all callers that call in, if possible. So far, it's been possible, and I appreciate it. I'd love to get to a point where it's not possible, or where I have to limit everybody to 5 minutes and move on. That would be awesome. No, actually, I don't know. But don't let that deter you. While there's still time to get in, call in. We kind of missed SkyTweet and Mariana this week, but we hope they're doing well. I'd like to thank everybody who came to the chat as well. For instance, Jake18, Jamalama, JuicePSU, that's OJ, our buddy who called in the first week, Bill Kava, a number of guests, and 803. Who else is here? I think that's it. So, thanks again for joining us. Remember, winter is coming.
Been listening to Podcast Winterfell, a podcast dedicated to the Game of Thrones series on HBO with your host Matt Murdock. Find the podcast blog at podcastwinterfell.wordpress.com. You can submit feedback by sending an email to podcastwinterfell@gmail.com. Or you can follow Matt on Twitter, twitter.com/WinterfellPod. Or you can call area code 314-669-1840. Keep in mind that regular phone or long distance charges may apply.